From KCPW in Salt Lake City, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. It's a question that new parents often get asked, does your baby sleep with you? Bed sharing and co-sleeping, where you attach a sidecar crib to your bed, have been unfashionable for decades. But the attachment parenting movement is changing that. Attachment parenting philosophy rejects the let them cry it out approach to sleep and instead encourages sleeping in close proximity to a baby or toddler in either the same room or the same bed. The big question about co-sleeping is it safe? Many worry they'll roll onto baby during deep sleep or that a pillow could cause harm. Today on the program, we're talking about the benefits and risks of sleeping with baby. Plus, blogging as therapy for new moms. All that and your calls after the news. Good morning. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. A Utah appeals court ruled last week that there's enough evidence that co-sleeping caused a baby to suffocate and that the infant's parents should go to trial. In many ways, it's an unusual case in that it's the second child who has died while in bed with parents Trevor Merrill and Echo Nielsen. But it does open the door to questions surrounding co-sleeping. And I guess the first of those is sharing a bed with a baby safe. Ever. Today on the program, the controversy surrounding co-sleeping and bed sharing. Joining us this hour, Dr. Jennifer Brinton. She's been a pediatrician for over 10 years. She works at Primary Children's Medical Center, and she's also an adjunct assistant professor at the University of Utah with a special interest in accident and disease prevention and child and family advocacy. And Dr. Brinton joins me in studio. Doctor, good morning.
Good morning, Jennifer. Thank you for inviting me on the show.
Later on in the program, how blogging can take the edge off motherhood for new moms. But first, safe sleeping. Have children changed the sleeping arrangements in your household? Does your child sleep in your bedroom or in your bed? Give us a call with your thoughts. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Dr. Brinton is a pediatrician. Is this question about co-sleeping one that crops up over and over? Is it a top concern for new parents?
You know, it's one of the concerns parents have. Obviously, parents want to avoid injury to their children, but they also have behaviors they want to do in the home. And talking with families about how to be as safe as they can with infant sleep is one of the important things we do with newborns or even with expectant mothers, since there are things that expectant mothers can do to help decrease their baby's risk of SIDS even then.
Mm-hmm. According to the Utah Department of Health, in a two-year period from 2003 to 2005, about 100 babies died without warning when the baby was put down to sleep or when left alone and not checked for a period of time. And one-third of those deaths took place while the baby was sleeping in the same bed with parents or siblings or when the baby was sharing a crib with a twin. So these co-sleeping deaths, not exactly common, but they do happen. There are risks there.
There are. And you can see the risks if you think about what the safe sleep environment would be for a baby. If you're imagining how a baby should sleep in a safe setting, you'd see a baby placed to sleep on his or her back on a firm mattress with a thin blanket tucked under their armpits and nothing else in the bed. It'd also be in a room that's comfortably cool, shared by the parents if possible, with no one smoking around the baby.
Hmm. I want to walk through some of those guidelines. Those are from the American Academy of Pediatrics. But more generally, according to the Department of Health, most newborn deaths who come home but die within that first year of life are sleep related. It's kind of sobering. You mentioned earlier in your comments that, you know, this is one way, one path to danger for infants, but it's not the only way. You mentioned SIDS. What is SIDS?
So SIDS is sudden infant death syndrome. Some babies seem to be more prone to SIDS, babies that were preterm or low birth weight or who have other abnormalities. So some babies come genetically more predisposed to SIDS. But there's also sudden unexpected infant death, which would be death attributed to strangulation or suffocation in a bed or a fall from a bed. So these are both types of things that you can have in the sleeping environment. And although it's true that some children are genetically or because of how they were born, they're more susceptible to SIDS itself, environmental changes have been shown to decrease the death risk even for those high-risk children.
Hmm. We're speaking with Dr. Jennifer Brenton. She's a pediatrician and an adjunct assistant professor at the University of Utah, also works at Primary Children's Medical Center. And we're talking about co-sleeping, safe sleeping with your infant. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255 if you'd like to join us. Let's walk through those most recent guidelines by the American Academy of Pediatrics on the topic of infant sleep. First off, you mentioned a baby is safest on its back. Why should a baby sleep on its back?
You know, there are a couple of main reasons that they think babies are safest on their backs. One thing is a baby sleeping on their back is more arousable. Babies that sleep on their tummies actually have decreased arousability. Also, when babies are on their tummies, they can rebreathe their carbon dioxide. And in an immature brain, that actually turns off the urge to breathe instead of stimulating the urge to breathe like it should in a more mature brain. Also, babies on their tummies are more vulnerable to becoming overheated. And overheating is a separate risk factor for SIDS.
Okay. The guidelines also recommend sharing the room with a baby, that evidence of that kind of arrangement decreases the risk of death by as much as 50%.
Yes.
Why is that?
You know, parents are more able to hear a baby that might be distressed, and they're more able to see if a baby is becoming, you know, for at least for the sudden unexpected infant death issues with the strangulation and the suffocation, which are possibly more common than the SIDS. They're able to see the environment a bit more and able to respond more quickly if a baby is distressed. So they recognize the distress more easily, and they can respond more quickly to prevent suffocation and death.
Interestingly, the APA does not recommend any specific bed sharing situations as safe. Bed sharing situations, what does that mean?
Well, so there, you know, epidemiologic studies have not shown that being in the bed with a baby decreases the risk of SIDS. We know that being in the room with a baby decreases unexpected death, mm-hmm. and we know that breastfeeding decreases unexpected death. We know that sharing a room with a baby increases the success of breastfeeding. Because there are other risk factors in an adult bed and other risk factors with those adults, there aren't specific studies that show that type of bed sharing is always safe for children. Mm-hmm. We know certain situations where you should not bed share and certain things you can do to make it less risky if you're committed to bed sharing. But we can't say you can bed share with no risk.
And so bed sharing, when we're talking about that, that's actually bringing the baby into your bed. Co-sleeping is something a little bit different?
Well, so bed sharing to nurse a baby or to comfort a baby, and then you put the baby back into their own bed is considered separate than co-sleeping. So co-sleeping would be sleeping with your parent. I know they separate out, you know, bed sharing or co-sleeping. I think what the intent is, you can be in a bed with a baby if the adult's awake in certain settings. And that doesn't have the risk factors that co-sleeping, so when adult's not no longer alert, when adult's asleep, an adult's asleep, that's a different situation. So that's, when they talk about how they can't say that co-sleeping is for sure safe, that's what they mean.
And the APA does specifically say that the attachment that you put to a bed, not recommended.
You know, it's not that it's that one should avoid it, it's that there's not safety data. So again, these recommendations are based on safety data. And so there's not safety data to say that that's for sure a safe thing. And as more research comes out or products are tested more, that could change.
Keeping soft objects away from a baby, certainly a pillow would present a problem for an infant.
Right.
But other things, and you mentioned a very thin blanket is recommended.
Right. What you're trying to do is avoid things that can go around the baby's face to make them rebreathe their air, or things that can the baby can become entangled or entrapped in. If a baby were on an adult's bed, you think about a soft, you know, a pillow top mattress or a water bed or comforters or quilts or pillows. Those would be dangerous to a baby because it could make them rebreathe their own air. Loose objects in the bed could also become something that babies could become entrapped in. So the rebreathing of the own air you think of as a risk for SIDS, but baby's face is being pushed up against a soft object so they can't breathe, that's suffocation, or getting entangled, that's strangulation. And those are all, you know, issues that can make a baby die during sleep.
There are certainly a lot of products out there in the marketplace that profess to help parents or keep babies safe, prevent SIDS, you know, the wedges. Do any of these work?
You know, once babies become more mobile, they can unfortunately wiggle around enough so that those objects become hazards. Babies can again push their faces up again to either rebreathe their air or to not be able to breathe. So those objects have not been shown to be safe. There's no object you can put in a bed that's been shown to be safe for a baby to help prevent the risk of SIDS. Even home monitors have not been shown to decrease the risk of SIDS. So what has been shown is breastfeeding a baby, co-sleeping with a baby, avoiding tobacco smoke during pregnancy and after a baby's born, and again, having the baby on their back in a cool environment with no other things around their faces.
Hmm. We're speaking with Dr. Jennifer Brinton. She's a pediatrician who works at Primary Children's Medical Center. We're talking about co-sleeping, sleeping with your baby, and there is some controversy surrounding that issue. If you've got questions or comments, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. So how real is this fear that a parent would roll over onto a baby and smother it? Is that a real concern?
You know, it can happen. One thing they found is that it happens more if a parent's particularly fatigued, which I'm sure no newborn parent has ever felt particularly fatigued.
Sure.
It also happens more, it seems that if you are going to co-sleep, it's safest to co-sleep with the parent, not another non-parent adult. It seems that the parents are more attuned to a baby and are more able to be aroused. Also, if a parent has been taking medications, either prescribed or illicit, including alcohol, that affect their ability to arouse, it's recommended that they don't co-sleep. Also, if families smoke, they shouldn't co-sleep with a baby. In fact, a baby born to a mother who smoked during pregnancy should actually not co-sleep because the nicotine actually changes the unborn baby's brain to make it less arousable. Those babies actually are more vulnerable to SIDS. So if you smoked while pregnant or you currently smoke or have a smoker in your home, even if there's no smoking in the bed, that's such a high risk factor. Those babies should never co-sleep,
never.
Which surprised me when I read that data.
Yeah. But the proponents of co-sleeping say that, you know, parents, new parents, are really fatigued. They're exhausted. And maybe that's one reason why they don't want to get out of bed and breastfeed. So in some ways, the co-sleeping arrangement encourages, it urges new parents to breastfeed. Is there any data on that? Does it support breastfeeding?
So being in the same room with a baby does support breastfeeding. So that data is clear. Breastfeeding a baby and co-sleeping doesn't have the same protective effect against SIDS as breastfeeding a baby with sleeping in the same room. So again, you know, I mean, there are a lot of environments that have risks that children aren't going to suffer from those risks. But if you're looking at decreasing the risks, being in the same room with a child and having a child close by, where you can reach out and touch them even, but not having them in your bed if you're asleep, is the best way to be with a baby and to promote the breastfeeding. That, and studies have shown that being in the same room does promote breastfeeding, but being out of the same bed doesn't decrease the effectiveness of breastfeeding, which is good to know.
What about bottle-fed babies? Is it safe to bottle-feed a baby in bed?
You know, the benefit of breastfeeding is actually directly related to how exclusive it is. So the more exclusive breastfeeding is, the more effective it is at preventing SIDS. But any breastfeeding, whether it's in a bottle, breast milk's in a bottle, or from the breast, has been shown to help decrease the risk of SIDS. Bottle feeding in the bed has other issues that aren't associated with SIDS, you know, ear infection risk or having babies have issues with their teeth later on. But bottle fed babies with breast milk in the bottle have the same benefit that breastfed babies have with SIDS reduction.
We're speaking with Dr. Jennifer Brinton, a pediatrician at Primary Children's Medical Center, also adjunct professor at the University of Utah. We're talking about co-sleeping, bed sharing with your infant. If you have questions or comments or would like to join us with your stories, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. We need to take a quick break, but we'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce, and this is City Views. Sleep presents many questions for new parents. How do I soothe a new baby? Where should I put that crib? Or do we need a crib at all? Sleeping with infants has some practical appeal for breastfeeding moms, but is it safe and is it for everyone? We're speaking with Dr. Jennifer Brenton this morning. She's a pediatrician at Primary Children's Medical Center. If you've got questions or comments or stories about how you brought baby to bed, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Part of the co-sleeping appeal is just having that baby close to you. You're nurturing, you're bonding with the child in a way that maybe, I guess, practically we all need to sleep, so you might as well spend that time with your baby. Are there benefits, you know, emotional, developmental benefits to sleeping with your child?
You know, we know that being responsive to your child, especially in the first 6 months of life, responding to their crying, being there to soothe them, being there to comfort them, having that touch actually helps babies be more emotionally healthy and less demanding that second 6 months of life. So we know, we have research to say that being a responsive parent is helpful for babies. When you're sleeping, it's hard to be a very responsive parent, you know. Mm-hmm. And again, we talked about how, you know, we know the safe sleep environment for a baby, a firm setting, no soft materials around, decreasing the fall risk. So if you are committed to co-sleeping with a baby and you can envision your bed to be as close to that ideal safe sleep environment as possible for a baby, then that reduces the risk of co-sleeping. Again, having babies in the home, I know what we did with our babies. We had our little one right next to us in a bassinet, so I could reach my hand in and comfort him when I needed to, and it was easy to pull him in and breastfeed him and then get him right back in the bassinet where I could again touch and see him and that. So there are lots of ways to remain close without the co-sleeping. But, you know, my hope when I talk with parents is that when they make the decisions in their own home for what works best with their family setting, they consider the risks and benefits, and they consider how to make things as safe as they can while still considering their individual situation.
One of the as someone who loves sleep and prizes sleep whenever I can get it, what about the disruption of sleep patterns? And I suppose that can happen whether or not your baby is in bed with you. But it seems to me that a baby who's kind of fidgety or whatever would disrupt the deep sleep that parents really need to get. Is there any research on that or studies on that?
You know, I'm not aware of all the studies with sleep between parents and children, more of the safety issues. One thing actually is we actually want parents to be more arousable and not be as deep sleeping with infants, and that seems to be the case. That seems to be why it's less dangerous to sleep with a parent than it is with another adult. Mm. Parents are more naturally arousable if they're not exhausted, and if they haven't taken medications to blunt that arousability. So you actually want that arousability as a protection both for you and for your baby.
That's a safety issue. Will a baby sleep through the night sooner if that baby shares a bed with parents? Any data to show that might be part of the mix?
You know, I have not seen data that says that. And again, we know that babies sleep more deeply and are less arousable if they're on their tummies. But we know that deep sleep and that decreased arousability is actually a risk factor for babies. So having a baby who's able to be aroused is actually a protection for a baby.
Hmm. I think in some ways this conversation we have is culturally constructed. I mean, I would imagine that not many places, it may not be the social custom in other countries that parents would have a separate bedroom for a child, that co-sleeping, that bed sharing is the way we do it, I mean, as humans. So do you find that this conversation is strange in any way?
You know, it's interesting. When you look at the epidemiologic data from different cultures, there are some cultures who bed share in a safer environment, and some who do so in a less safe environment. So some cultures have a decreased risk of SIDS compared to others that have a higher risk. You know, having a bed that's up on a bed frame, you know, and with a room with a hard floor is not something that most cultures, that a lot of, you know, other cultures have. It's not something we've had for years and years and years. So some cultures that might co-sleep more safely would be on a thin mat on the floor with a baby on the mat next to them. You know, they're your co-sleeping, but but you don't have the materials. You again, that safe sleep environment you imagine for a baby is met naturally, more naturally in some cultures than it is in others.
We're speaking with Dr. Jennifer Brinton, a pediatrician at Primary Children's Medical Center. We're talking about co-sleeping, about bed sharing, and sleep and babies. If you have any questions or comments, 801-355-TALK is our number, and we'll go to the phones. And Rick is joining us from Salt Lake. Rick, hi.
Hello.
Hi. Go right ahead.
So I have a child that's about 6 weeks old, and he has some...
Congratulations.
Thank you. He had some respiratory distress right after delivery. Not a ton of it, but he inhaled some meconium. And I've noticed that he has been a very noisy sleeper and that he gasps a lot. He grunts a lot while he's sleeping. And it kind of scares me. I have two other children, and they weren't quite as noisy. It sounds like maybe he's kind of mucousy when he's breathing, and a lot of times he'll... You know, I can make the noises. He'll go, you know, in the middle of the night. And I'm wondering if, first of all, if the fact that he had some respiratory distress during delivery makes him an increased risk of SIDS, and how worried I should be when he makes a lot of breathing noises while he's sleeping.
Dr. Brinton.
Yeah, those are great questions. And I'm sure you've been talking with your pediatrician or your family doctor about that, because that would be the best setting to make sure that your baby's not, you know, having any other issues.
But no, we have. And he checks out as far as not having respiratory distress. It's just, I guess, kind of a general question, since you seem to be an expert on infant sleep, how worried should we be about noises?
Well, some noises show that babies are doing a great job protecting their airway. So the coughing and the gagging, you can sometimes hear that kind of, you know, show that babies are keeping saliva or anything that might be spit up out of their airway, and those are good protective reflexes. Some babies have a bit of a floppy airway, and so they get a little noisier, especially when they breathe in as they get older, you know, the first few weeks to months of life, they might seem a little bit noisier. And again, that's not a problem for a lot of babies, but if you feel like your baby is working hard to breathe or, you know, turning blue, things like that, you really should let your doctor know that you're noticing those things.
He's not turning blue or anything, but one thing we've been doing that's been helping is we have him sleep in either his little baby bath or his car seat, so he's kind of at an incline, and that seems to, you know, help him fidget less. And I guess, I don't know, is that something that's recommended?
You know,
keeping them a little bit upright.
That's one thing we haven't discussed yet on this show. One risk about car seats and other things that have babies a little bit up is that babies, especially babies under 3 months, have immature neck muscles, and they can have their heads fall forward a little bit to block off their airway a bit more. So you're right, the idea of having a baby, you know, sleep at an angle seems to be great, because you think you're having gravity help you out, you're having things be pulled down, but unfortunately, at least with car seats where kids are actually bent in the middle, it actually increases the risk of airway obstruction. And so if you feel like you need to do that, again, that'd be something to talk to your doctor about. Saying what you've noticed and showing what you're doing, and they can guide you on some ways to adjust things that might be safe specifically for your baby.
Rick, before I let you go, you sound like you're an experienced father. You've got three young children in your household. Have you ever brought any of them into your bed?
You know, I haven't, for the same reason that has kind of been alluded to. I'd be afraid I'd roll over on him. And I think my wife's the same thing. We have quite a small house, though, so, and the baby's room's right next to ours, so it's almost like we're in the same room. I mean, I can hear the gasping. But no, we've never, I'd be terrified, I guess, to have a child in the bed sleeping next to us, you know.
Rick, thanks very much for the call, and congratulations.
Yes.
Thank you.
801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Again, we're speaking with Dr. Jennifer Brinton, a pediatrician at Primary Children's Medical Center, about sleeping, infant sleep, co-sleeping, bed sharing. 801-355-TALK is our number. Before Rick's call, we were talking about sort of the culture around sleep and when a new child comes into a household. There is a perception in our culture, at least, that the bed is an exclusive place for intimacy between parents, that children do not belong there. Do you see that we are shifting away from that view a little bit?
Great question. You know, when you talk with parents, it does seem that a lot of parents are spending more time with their children in their bed, either briefly to be able to nurse or have that cuddle time, or, you know, with older children, you know, it does seem that, that families report that a bit more. I haven't seen the data on, you know, on the incidence and that. I know we talked earlier off air about studies showing that maybe up to 70% of parents in some settings do co-sleep with a child of some age. Mm-hmm. So it does seem that we are, you know, we're more child-centric than we perhaps were before. And again, being child-centric in a way that can be safe for a baby, you know, there are many ways to do that. You having the baby in your room, being able to touch them, having them with you to nurse, and then considering, again, that safe sleep environment, that cooler room, that firm mattress, that avoidance of things around babies' faces can help you both be child-centric and child-safe.
We'll go back to the phones, and Bob is joining us from Brighton. Bob, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you. Go right ahead.
I was just wondering whether the size, weight, or body mass index of the co-sleeping parent makes any difference. Has that been studied?
You know, that has been looked at, actually, particularly with mothers. And the weight of a mother has not been associated with the increased risk of death with co-sleeping with a baby. Though some people say that if you are larger, excessively large, it might be hard to sense if you've gotten near a baby. But again, the data does not show that there's an increased risk of the unexpected infant death co-sleeping with a parent, or at least a mother, of different weights.
Okay, well, thank you. I'm surprised, but thank you.
I was too.
Bob, thanks very much for the call. 801-355-TALK is our number. We'll go to Amber from Salt Lake City. Amber, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just had a couple of comments about co-sleeping. I have a 4-year-old and I have a 5-month-old, and my 4-year-old daughter, I co-slept with her until she was a year old. Obviously, I breastfed her, and that made it so much easier. I got some sleep. We both were arousable. I never thought that I would roll over her. I was always aware of where she was in my bed. With my son, however, he's a lot noisier. He grunts a lot in his sleep, and I can't have him in there because I don't get as much sleep. But I actually take him into bed with me in that third feeding at night when I'm exhausted. But I think that it's great. I've never thought that I would roll over on him. I've always been aware of where they're at.
Amber, I have a question. Just uh-huh. Logistically, in a bed, is the baby in between you and your husband or on a side?
He's between myself and my husband. Generally, when they are in our bed, we don't have the heavy quilt on. We'll both have, you know, warmer pajamas on so that we're not covering his face or whatever with the heavy quilt that we have. But he's between us both, and he's never really had the fear of rolling over on him either.
So why do you do it?
Why?
Mm-hmm.
I get more sleep. and, you know, it's also a closeness issue. I would say with my 4-year-old, I worked full-time, and she actually quit taking a bottle during the day. So she would nurse all night long, and I was not getting any sleep at all with her in her own bed. And I found that I could just roll over and nurse her, and we'd both fall back asleep, and I got a lot more sleep that way. And, you know, there's nothing better than cuddling with your little tiny baby in those wee hours of the morning and, you know, just having them put their little hand on your face. I mean, those moments you just can't get back, and those are only such a short time. But I realize that it's not for everyone. You know, a lot of people look at me like I'm crazy when I say that I sleep with my kids, but I really enjoy it.
Amber, thanks very much for sharing that. 801-355-TALK is our number. Dr. Brinton, comments?
You know, as Amber brings up, you know, when she is bed sharing, she's still trying to envision that ideal environment for a sleeping baby. You know, the firm surface, avoiding soft, fluffy things around the baby's face, having two parents who are able to be aroused more easily, and, you know, likely a smoke-free environment. So she's considering the ways to help reduce, and again, trying to approach as safe an environment as she can for her baby.
801-355-TALK is our number. We'll go back to the phones, and Jason is joining us from Salt Lake City. Jason, hi.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
I couldn't wait for the show. I told my wife yesterday about the show, and she's at work, but I told her I was calling in, and I'm glad I got through.
Well, thanks.
We're new parents. Our son is almost a year old, and we have co-slept from the beginning, and it's been an amazing experience. I was a little apprehensive at first, from all of the literature that I had read and the things that you hear from other parents, and and also from our pediatrician, sort of saying that we shouldn't do it. But my wife convinced me. I'm a heavy sleeper, but my wife convinced me that we should at least try it. She felt comfortable, and that put me at ease. And we had a twin bed at first, and he slept with us, and she's breastfed the whole year. We recently just got a king size bed, but he sleeps in the middle between the two of us. I find that I don't sleep as heavy as I used to. That it's difficult to say that I'm aware when at night, but I do feel that I can feel him next to me, and my wife feels the same way. And it's been nothing but a positive experience for us. We'd do it again, and also I don't think either one of us are embarrassed. When we're talking to new parents, to say that it worked for us. It might not be the perfect situation for you, but it definitely worked for us, and we would definitely do it again with our second child. And it just feels so nurturing. You feel so close to your child. And I wish that more, maybe more pediatricians, more new parents of newborns would be given some alternate information about co-sleeping instead of it being looked at as a very negative thing in our society.
Jason, you mentioned she's a year, or your child's a year old now. So,
yep.
How long are you going to do this?
Well, that's our next discussion. I think we're going to. I mean, my wife is still breastfeeding, and I think we're going to begin the weaning process, and we're also going to start having another child here probably in the next six or eight months. So that's a discussion that we'll have to have, but we haven't had it yet. I think once he gets to a year, we'll probably explore that and talk to our pediatrician about it. But like I said, it's been an amazing experience for us. And like I said, it might not be for everybody, but for us, it was just a great decision.
Jason, thanks for sharing that. 801-355-TALK is our number. I want to sneak in one last call, and this is Tom from Salt Lake. Tom, welcome.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
We have three kids. All three of them slept with us. Our first son, this is a long time ago, back in the early 80s, but we had read stories about the family bed and just were so afraid of, SIDS and that, oh my gosh, what if something happens to him? And so my son actually slept on my chest. I slept on my back, and he just slept on my chest and you asked about how long, and it was until they wanted to leave, really, and it was probably after, a year or so, they just, they were just ready to be on their own. And I think it gave them more confidence, as a baby that they just seemed a lot more confident in knowing that they had their, they didn't go through those moments of terror where they're alone and nobody was there with them. And I think that, because we were right there, if they woke up and needed something, we were right there, and it didn't teach them to cry or that they had to scream for what they wanted or scream that they were just, in discomfort or something.
Tom, thank you very much for sharing that. Dr. Brinton, to Jason's comment that he wishes doctors would rethink advice for parents or give them alternative options, what do you think about that?
We want to make sure we're giving parents all the data we can so they can make their best decisions they can. And again, we're not saying that the parents should absolutely never co-sleep, but we can say we don't have data saying that can be 100% safe, but we do have data on how to make it safer. And so again, I think the parents who called in have reported, that they're not, they're arousable, they're using these firm sleeping settings, they're avoiding soft materials near a baby's face, they're having their babies mostly on their back, or tummy on tummy is another safe way if you don't roll over on the baby. Mm. So they're putting babies in a situation where they're as safe as they can be in this setting, and it's worked for their family. It's something that's worked for their family. So that's the guidelines that we're given is that though we can't ever say it's 100% safe, if families choose to co-sleep for other reasons, for reasons that are important to them, we'd like to give them guidelines on how to make it as safe as possible, and also let them know the situations in which they should never co-sleep, which again would be if parents smoke, or if a baby was born to a mother who smoked, or again if parents are drowsy from medication, or they're in a soft surface like the waterbed, a couch, an easy chair, things like that, places where it's just the risks are just too great. But the families who called in have reported really wonderful decision-making with keeping a safe environment for their babies. And that would be the goal if you are co-sleeping.
Dr. Jennifer Brenton, she's a pediatrician at Primary Children's Medical Center, also adjunct assistant professor at the University of Utah. And Dr. Brenton, thanks very much for your time today.
You're welcome. Thank you for sharing with me. And I appreciate hearing the stories from people who called in as well.
We need to take a break, but we'll be right back after the break. The upside of mommy blogs. But first a break. This is City Views on KCPW, Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce. Well, the blogosphere is full of moms. Blogging went mainstream in the early part of the century. Moms have embraced this new medium with enthusiasm. There are about 4 million mommy blogs out there, and now research shows there are emotional upsides to the practice. Joining me now to talk about the benefits of mommy blogging, Dr. Erin Holmes. She's an assistant professor in the Department of Family Life at Brigham Young University, and she joins me in studio. And Dr. Holmes, thanks so much for being here.
You are welcome. So glad to be here.
Also with us, Karina Hoskison Wataias. I think I got that right. Wataias, a freelance. I just know her as Asukar.
That's right.
A freelance writer and national editor of todaysmama.com. She's been writing The Jet Set, her personal blog, for 9 years, has been blogging for 13. She has 3 kids, 8, 4, and 6 months. She lives in Provo, but she joins us today in studio. And Karina, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
You are welcome to join us if you're a mommy blogger or follow a mommy blog. Give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Dr. Holmes, let's start with you and the research. First of all, I know this wasn't your study, but you're familiar with it. How was the study structured?
Well, this is a study of 157 new moms that I worked on with another colleague, Sarah Coyne at BYU, and with one of our students, Brandon McDaniel, who's now getting his PhD at Penn State. So we had 157 new moms, all of whom were transitioning to parenthood, who had just transitioned within the last 6 months. And we were really interested in learning about their blogging and their media use in general. So we found only moms who use the internet regularly. And we just wanted to see how blogging influenced their connection to extended family and friends, and how that connection to extended family and friends would ultimately influence their social support.
Okay, so what did you find?
Mm-hmm. So it does. We looked at social support. So blogging does help moms feel close, feel connected to their extended family and friends. And as a result, they feel social support. And the reason we care so much about social support is that social support influences a mom's parenting stress. It influences the way she perceives her satisfaction with her marriage, but also conflict in her marriage. And transition to parenthood researchers know that becoming a parent can have negative effects on marriage. So we really care about what's going on there between parents. The other thing that matters so much about social support and why blogging matters is that when moms feel socially supported, their stress goes down, and that means their likelihood for depression decreases. So all of us who are worried about postpartum depression, depression setting in as moms are becoming new parents, blogging seems to help that.
Get online.
Yeah, get online.
How did you react to the result? Any surprises in that?
Well, you know, there were debates about what blogging might do for moms. Some people say, of course, blogging is going to help you feel support, help you feel connected to other people. Other people say, yeah, but blogging means moms are online all the time. They aren't necessarily taking care of their family. They aren't taking care of their kids. And when they're online, they're just bombarded by all of this consumerist ideology. And maybe it's going to make them feel worse about themselves. In fact, if they're online, they might be more isolated. So we didn't know. We didn't know what blogging was going to mean. Of course, I'm really happy to find out that blogging is good. So many of my friends have emailed me, so Erin, it's okay that I'm online 2 hours a day doing my blog. And I can validate that.
Dr. Aaron Holmes, assistant professor in the Department of Family Life at BYU. Also with us, Karina Hoskison-Watayas. She's a freelance writer and a blogger. So when you heard the results of the study, Karina, what went through your mind?
Duh.
What got you started blogging? You've been doing this for years.
I have been doing this for years. Well, first of all, I've been online for a very long time, and blogging is just a natural extension for me. I'm a writer. That's what I do for my living. But I wanted a way of being able to write what I wanted to write and not necessarily all of the business content and all of the other things that I was needing to write for my everyday job. And it really did pick up after the birth of my first child. And just being able to have that outlet, that creative outlet, that emotional outlet, and being able to put that not necessarily out there for anyone to read, but just to clear my own psyche, just to get it out there so that I could deal with my emotions from day to day.
How does it differ? How does a blog differ, though, from a diary?
That's a good question. I think with a diary, it's really hard to get people to read your diary. So, I mean, you could take it to the grocery store and hand it to people, but people are really busy. But at least with a blog, when you're writing on a blog, people find you, or you find people. And it just starts out really small, and you build a little community of people that come in and check in on you. It could be friends, and then gradually other people might wander across your blog, and you start building a little bit of community of commenters that come back every day, and you read other people's blogs, and it just begins to lift everybody up.
Hmm. Is that, from an academic perspective, Dr. Holmes, is that the difference between a blog and a diary? A diary is a place where you can purge and get rid of some of that angst, but it's not necessarily a social environment.
Mm-hmm. I think that's what we're really finding here. I mean, moms who are blogging are telling us that they want to share their personal experiences with other people. So, I mean, if you're writing your diary, maybe, your kids will pick up your diary someday and feel a connection to you. That's great. But like Karina said, I mean, there's this whole network of people out there who can find you and who you can find through blogging that just isn't the same through just journaling. And I think that's why that connection to family and friends enhances women's feelings of social support, and why that makes it different. I think writing is great. There's a lot of research in psychology on the importance of just journaling for yourself. I mean, your own sense of efficacy and your own ability to purge and reduce stress. But this seems to be about social connection, not just purging. It might even be why it's so beneficial, because you get the combined impact of both.
Hmm. And I think in this world where people move and they are away from their primary families, from their parents, from their cousins, from their extended, from their local support networks, blogging becomes a way that you can keep in touch with friends and family who have moved across the country, around the world, and keep those connections that are so important for women.
We're talking about mommy blogging and the psychological and social benefits of it. Give us a call if you follow a blog or if you're a blogger yourself. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Well, I see these upsides, but then I think, wow, this is you putting yourself out there in a very personal way, in a very public platform. Did you ever, Karina, have hesitation about being so intensely personal about, your kids are fighting or what to have for dinner or whatever you blog about, cookies?
Yes, I exclusively blog about cookies. So this is great that you guys have me here today. Honestly, it is a push-pull about your privacy. You want to be careful about what you're sharing with people. There's a great deal that I never share. Most of the time it's because it's boring and no one wants to hear about it. But the secondary part is you have to balance the concerns of your privacy and the needs of your family with your desire to express yourself and your need to emotionally download exactly everything that you have doing. I mean, as somebody once said, nobody cares what you have for lunch. Nobody cares about some of those little tiny things every day that you do. But people might care that you're feeling down because they're feeling down as well. Or they might care that you had a great day or something funny happened or some way of sharing. Basically, it's kind of what you would share with an extended group of friends. Not necessarily what you would share with your best friend.
Though. It's so different because anybody in the world could chime in on this conversation.
But that's part of the charm of it, is that you really can reach out to a huge
a whole number of people out there that feel the same way you do. And, you know, I've been online now for almost 20 years, and I think the good balances out the bad. Yes, there are terrible elements out there, but there's so much benefit, and there's such a great community of people out there that really do connect with each other and really do lift each other up. Mm-hmm.
We're talking with Karina Hoskeson Watayas. I'll get this name by the end of the hour.
It's fine. Don't worry about it.
Freelance writer, the writer of The Jet Set, her personal blog, and national editor of todaysmama.com. Also with us, Dr. Erin Holmes, assistant professor in the Department of Family Life at BYU. If you have questions or comments about mommy blogging, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. And let's go to the phones. And Rachel is joining us from Salt Lake City. Rachel, hi.
Hi. I am just curious, what is the age, the average age of the mommy blogger? And where do you see it drop off at a certain age of women that don't blog at all?
That's an interesting question, Rachel. I mean, are you seeing, Dr. Holmes, in your sample, is it new moms? Is it middle-aged folks who are going through the teenage years? What is it?
Well, it's kind of tricky because these are all new moms. So the average age is 27 years old. So I don't really know nationally what the average age of women is who are blogging. But I can tell you that Karina and I are older than 27.
That's right. A little bit.
And we're still blogging. So
thank you.
It's a great question, Rachel.
All right.
I will say that you do see a concentration in those early childbearing years with a natural decline as you get into the late 30s and early 40s. Although there are plenty of women out there that are in their 40s that are blogging, and then later on as grandmothers, there are some bloggers out there. But there is a concentration in your 20s and 30s out there. I think it's simply a function of being more digitally literate, period, versus necessarily an age difference.
Hmm. And who follows your blog? Do you have a sense?
I do. Just being able to look at my statistics, it's more urban. I have concentrations in California, Salt Lake, Texas, basically in those and Washington. Can't forget my Washington people. But it really is women, the majority of women, and the majority are in their 20s, in their mid-30s, and then I have several readers that are a little bit older than that.
Mm-hmm. Rachel, thanks very much for the call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Dr. Holmes, in your study, did you look at content at all, what people are writing about?
No, we didn't look at content very much. What I can say is that 76% of the moms in our studies read blogs, and 61% were writing their own. But other than the fact that I know that they were writing and reading, a lot of moms were, all I know is they're doing it because they just really want to stay in touch with other people. They want to document their experiences.
In addition to building that social network, is it a form of therapy? Karina, do you find that you feel better after you put something out there?
Yes. It really is something that you can work, and sometimes you don't even know how you're feeling about something until you get it written down and you see it on a page and you see it there and you kind of work through it. And if you have to analyze it before it goes up into a blog post, if you have to say, okay, how am I feeling about this? And you just put it out there, it's absolutely a form of therapy.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Holmes, is that one of the factors that you looked at in your study?
We didn't look at whether or not women called it therapeutic, though, I mean, there's enough literature out there that suggests that just feeling connected to others is therapeutic, particularly for women. In fact, there's some biological research that talks about changes in women's stress hormone levels just through connecting with other people, that there are actually even potential gender differences, that for women, even more than men, that connection they're making when they reach out to others or when others reach out to them actually alters their physiology, helps reduce their stress.
Well, if there's an upside to it, what if nobody reads your blog? Could there be a downside to your sense of self if nobody's reading what you're putting out there?
Well, Karina? I can imagine it's possible.
You know what? Every blogger started out there with just themselves and maybe one other person reading it. And it has never, you know, most people do not jump into the blogging world and all of a sudden have 10,000 readers. That just doesn't happen, you know, unless you're Oprah. And even that doesn't really happen. Everybody starts out with just a few core people that are reading it. And it often starts out, I hear this time after time, because of a move,
because of some sort of significant life event where people feel like they need to start reaching out and connecting with their people.
Mm. What about social pressure, though? I mean, it is one more thing to do on your list. And as new moms, I mean, you're busy. You're running around. What about content comparing yourself to somebody else who's online? And
look
what
they're
writing about sounds much more exciting than
right.
what I'm writing.
That happens.
About.
And I mean, there's an element of, you know, putting a little bit of shellac and putting a little bit of varnish on things to make things shinier and happier. And I really hope that people don't do that. I mean, those kind of blogs are really attractive, especially to new moms who are looking for a way to look at their lives and wish that it was happier and wish that it was a little bit more fulfilling, because motherhood day to day can be drudgery. It can be real. It's a lot of work. And looking out there and being able to look at a glossy magazine in a form of a blog post is really attractive. But when people start to blog themselves, they have a choice to make of whether they're going to be real or whether they're going to try and put a veneer on it. And some people need to put a veneer on it just to deal with their everyday lives. They need to pick out the best stuff, the most beautiful things that happen to them every day, so that they remember who they are and where they want to be in their lives. And other people need to use blogging so that they can just as an emotional processing unit. So I wouldn't, you know, the comparisons are always going to be out there, but just like every person is an individual, every blog needs to be different.
Karina Hoskison-Watayez, she is national editor of Today's Mama, blogger of the Jet Set. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
And Dr. Erin Holmes, assistant professor in the Department of Family Life at BYU. Thanks to you.
Thank you.
City Views is a production of KCPW News. Next time, it's Politics Up Close with Jeff Robinson. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce.